Okay, now for our final speaker of this National Leadership Seminar. Sidney Powell has practiced law for many years, primarily in the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. She has been lead counsel in more than 500 federal appeals, 350 of them as an assistant United States attorney and appellate section chief in the Western and Northern Districts of Texas. She is a past president of the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers and the Bar Association of the 5th Federal Circuit, and she is a member of the American Law Institute. Many of you have heard or seen one of her frequent appearances on radio and television, including Lou Dobbs, Hannity, Shannon Bream, Laura Ingraham, Newsmax, One America News, and Mark Levin. A deep concern about prosecutorial overreach led her to write a best-selling book titled License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. And along those lines, she is currently working as one of the lawyers representing retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. I think some of you in this room may have heard of General Flynn. She will be speaking today on how to fix justice. Would you please welcome to the podium Sidney Powell.
Thank you all so much. I really am honored to be here and speak to this auspicious group. I've met a lot of fascinating and caring people. I want to thank you first for the gift of your time in being here today. That's the most valuable thing you can give anyone. It's the only one of our assets that cannot be replaced in any way, shape, or form. So I'm especially grateful that you care enough about all these issues and Hillsdale College to be a part of this. I think it's extraordinary. I literally prayed I would not have to write License to Lie, and I prayed I would not have to write it because for me to have to sit down and write it meant that the system of justice that I believed in and had practiced in for, I guess, about 25 years by that time was broken. And that was a very, very sad thing for me. So it was extremely emotional to write the book. And I wrote it because I, in that way of telling a story, because I wanted people to feel the toll that a wrongful criminal conviction takes on everyone in the process. It is outrageous. It is devastating. And if you have not been in the unfortunate position of having the entire might and weight of the United States Department of Justice focused against you to literally crush you, you cannot begin to comprehend what it's like for those who are. And I would venture to guess that approximately 5% of our current prison population, state and federal, is completely innocent. And another 5% at least is or was the subject of a trial so unfair and judges so prejudiced that you can't tell if they were rightly convicted or not. That is a serious problem. In this country, we should not have one innocent person in prison. Mr. Arne and I were talking earlier at lunch about the whole separate topic of prison reform, which we need every bit as much as we need reform in the Department of Justice. But I will start by saying that I think the first way to fix justice right now is to drop the charges against Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. And we are in the process of trying to convince the Department of Justice to do that right now. The especially good news is that Attorney General Barr has assigned Mr. Jensen, the United States Attorney in Missouri, to take a look at the case. I'm not sure exactly what his role is. I understand he will not be appearing on the pleadings, and I wouldn't expect him to. But hopefully he's going to take a fresh and independent look at all the motions that we have filed since I came in the case, because we have outlined an atrocious series of injustices that should offend everyone in the country. They literally made up the charges against General Flynn, and the case against him exemplifies everything that is wrong now with our criminal justice system. We have prosecutors in the Department of Justice and across the United States Attorney's offices that have determined they can weaponize our system of justice to prosecute people for political reasons. They are expert at making up crimes, and they have become more expert, along with FBI agents, with making up facts to go with those crimes. That's exactly what we've seen in the case against General Flynn. There really is no case. He was honest with the agents. We learned with material the government did give us that the agents said they thought his demeanor was sure. He was being perfectly forthright with them, although he didn't remember some things. And they left that interview with him on January 24th in the White House, by which they ambushed him, by the way. You know, Mr. McCabe told him, oh, you don't need counsel. There's no reason for that, really, and led him to believe that it was an entirely different scenario. After I got in the case, we found out that they had even schemed and planned to interview him in such a way that he would not realize he was even being investigated. Because he was National Security Advisor, they didn't want to ruffle any feathers and leave with any sort of animosity coming from him that he was being investigated. So they planned. They had a series of meetings at the highest levels of the FBI to decide how and when to interview him in such a way that he would not even realize he was the subject of the interview, much less being advised of his rights, which of course they didn't do because they didn't want to tip him off in the slightest way that they were investigating him. And since he's worked with FBI agents for any number of years in his career, he saw them as allies. And they even remarked about that after they left the interview, about how successful they were in keeping him relaxed and unguarded and thinking of them as friends. For the government to then bring a criminal prosecution against someone for alleged false statements in that kind of scenario is simply beyond the pale. I don't know of any other false statements prosecution in the history of our country that rests on unwarned, uninformed about even being the subject of an investigation, statements made to people you perceived as allies. That is the biggest setup of someone I have ever seen. And only in the last month, a little over a month now, did we learn that one of the two agents who interviewed General Flynn had been slipped surreptitiously into a sample presidential briefing of candidate Trump as the nominee on August 17, 2016, precisely for the purpose of assessing General Flynn's demeanor, taking notes and reporting back anything he might have said that would be relevant to the crossfire hurricane investigation, as they called it, of the purported Russia collusion, which we all know was a hoax. They sent him there to do that precise thing, and they hid that from General Flynn and his defense team the entire time, even though Judge Emmett Sullivan, who has the case, had issued what's called a Brady order, ordering the government to produce any evidence that might be favorable or material to the defense. Well, the fact that that agent had done that assessment of General Flynn and been in on that interview not only shows what we call egregious government misconduct, because it violated completely the trust that is supposed to exist between the nominee or the president and the people who do a presidential daily briefing like that. But it also showed that that agent's assessment of General Flynn then on the 24th, when he came out of that meeting with General Flynn, the ambush interview as I call it, his assessment and the validity of his belief that General Flynn was being honest and truthful with the agents just became exponentially greater and more valid. So there were two serious issues that arise from our notification that that agent was in, was in that meeting on August 17. Another thing it tells us is, and I think you'll find this particularly interesting, this just a brief timeline of what went on there. It was August 15, 2016, that we have the Page Strzok text messages, the two illicit FBI lovers that were having affairs, even though one was a counterintelligence agent and one was special counsel to Deputy Director McCabe. You would think they would have sense enough not to do something that would subject them or risk them being amenable to blackmail and all kinds of problems, but they did. They were both cheating on their spouses with each other, and somehow that they managed to keep that a secret from the world's best investigatory agency. Kind of calls it all into question, doesn't it? How good is the upper echelon of the FBI, or any of it for that matter, if the two top people on the Mueller squad and in the FBI can carry on like that and nobody notices? Not to mention over 50,000 text messages between the two of them. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out when they had time to work. And we've only seen a few of the text messages between them. The government, that's another thing they're hiding. They have not produced all the Strzok Page text messages, even all the ones that relate to General Flynn. But they were doing this, and on August 15 is when they text each other about the infamous insurance policy. We just discussed this in McCabe's office. It's like an insurance policy in the event that Trump is elected. August 16 is when they open the investigation against General Flynn. And August 17, the very next day, is when this agent, whose name I can't reveal, although the entire public, I think, knows who he is, but I've seen it under a protective order, so I can't tell you his name. But he goes into that presidential daily briefing to assess General Flynn, specifically in the event they need to interview him later as a subject. So it's just one act of extraordinary government misconduct after the other. The FBI actually cleared him completely of any offense, and there's a memo to that effect held within the Department of Justice dated January 30, 2017. That's while he was still in the White House. It exonerates him of being an agent of Russia. The agents reported back immediately on January 24th, doing three separate briefings of an hour each to all the upper echelon of DOJ and the FBI that they thought he was being honest. He showed no signs of lying. They believed him. And so they write that memo, and it's in the DOJ file. I still haven't been able to get Judge Emmett Sullivan to produce that to the defense. The government refuses to give it to us. They say, oh, it really doesn't matter because that doesn't have anything to do with the false statements he made on January 24th, 6 days earlier. Well, it has everything to do with it, and most people can see that. But Judge Sullivan, despite the fact he's actually the judicial hero of my book, License to Lie, because he presided over the prosecution of former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, the longest-serving Republican in the United States Senate. And if you remember, the prosecution of Senator Stevens had to be thrown out because the government had hidden evidence that showed Senator Stevens was innocent, and they had hidden evidence that showed that undermined the testimony of the government's few witnesses against him and completely contradicted the government's case. It's happening all over again now. When I wrote License to Lie, I did it to try to scream and wake up the general public to see how weaponized and politicized the Department of Justice had become. And it didn't just begin with Obama. It's been going on for at least 20 years, as best I can tell. It starts in the book with the Enron Task Force, which was created by President Bush and untethered from the Department of Justice, a group of handpicked prosecutors by Michael Chertoff and Larry Thompson and Bob Mueller. Sadly, they picked them because they were terrorists of prosecutors. That's not what a federal prosecutor is supposed to be. There is a Supreme Court decision called Berger versus United States that describes the role of an U.S. attorney or assistant U.S. attorney as being a representative of the sovereign whose job is to seek justice, not convictions. And when I was an assistant U.S. attorney in three different districts under nine different U.S. attorneys from both political parties across the country, Texas and Virginia, any U.S. attorney I worked with or for said, your job is to do the right thing. You know, make sure before you indict somebody that they're actually guilty, that it's a real crime. We don't need to stretch the law. We just need to enforce it. And that's what we did. Nobody ever chastised me for losing a jury trial, and I lost several. No one ever chastised me for what's called confessing error, which means sometimes as the appellate lawyer for the appellate section in San Antonio or Northern District, Texas, I had to go in and admit to the Fifth Circuit that the agents or the trial attorneys had done something wrong, that they had blown the case in some way and the conviction had to be reversed. The government doesn't do that now. They don't seem to have done that much, if any, in the last 20 years. And I don't know why that is. There is has been an extraordinary change in the culture of the FBI and the Department of Justice that must be reversed. And the time to reverse that is right now. This cannot go on any longer. I really like Attorney General Bill Barr. He understands the importance of the rule of law. If we don't reinstate the rule of law right now, our republic is going to be gone. I mean, that's how serious it is. At least 100 million people in the country see the two-tiered system we have. If you're a Republican, you're going to prison for years. If you're a Democrat, you get a pass. You don't have to look any farther than the special counsel's indictment of Paul Manafort, which whatever Manafort's real crimes were, and apparently there were some real tax crimes charged against him, the indictment also includes person A or B, I think, who was Tony Podesta, who committed some of the exact same offenses Mr. Manafort did, if not more. But was Tony Podesta indicted? No. Tony Podesta just closed down one company and went to start another or do something else. But he wasn't prosecuted at all. He was given a pass. And everyone can see the extraordinary crimes committed by Hillary Clinton that were actual offenses, like destroying the Blackberries and destroying hundreds of thousands of emails. And absolutely nothing was done. Immunity was handed out to her colleagues as if it was Halloween candy. And at the same time, 2 years later, everyone related to President Trump is indicted, have to sell their houses to pay legal fees, take out third mortgages to pay legal fees, and go to prison. We cannot survive as a republic with dual standards like that. And it's absolute death for the rule of law. I do believe Bill Barr understands that. Someone asked me earlier if this was a real tiff between Bill Barr and President Trump about the tweets. Probably yes and no. There's no danger of Bill Barr leaving. The president thinks the world of him. As I say it, the president's tweets often give voice to what the people are thinking. And Bill Barr is solid enough and self-assured enough and knows what he's doing to simply absolutely ignore the president's tweets. And if the president wants to take up a real issue with him, he can pick up the phone and call him, because Bill Barr does serve at the pleasure of the president of the United States. That's the way it ought to be. That's how voters are allowed to affect change. Who was it, Obama, who said elections have consequences? Well, hopefully the election of President Trump and the mandatory re-election of President Trump, if we're going to save the Republic. Will result in even more favorable changes, whether anyone else likes it or not, because the time is now. We simply cannot wait any longer. I applaud the president's pardons and commutations. There are even more that need to be made. Bernie Kerik was targeted after he was nominated as President Bush's Homeland Security person. No telling how many people he insulted and offended when he was police commissioner in New York, but I firmly believe that he was absolutely targeted, and I'm delighted the president gave him a pardon. I would encourage the president to put Bernie Kerik in charge of the Bureau of Prisons as high up as he could put him, because Kerik was also head of the New York prison system and cleaned up Rikers Island. He cut down inmate-on-inmate violence. He streamlined the budget. Everything worked better. He made dramatic improvements in Rikers. We need those same improvements made in our prison system because it is just a cesspool of corruption. There's hardly much difference between the criminals behind the bars in some instances and the ones outside the bars who are smuggling in drugs and all kinds of contraband and profiting from it and stealing blindly from the prison system itself. So that's, you know, that's how to fix the prison system. How to fix justice is to start changing the culture in the FBI, where they are trained at Quantico, and in the Department of Justice itself. There are a whole lot of people that need to be fired. And I really think it's time we start some kind of personality test for narcissism, and that narcissists should not apply. No matter how bad a criminal defendant is, and how much they need to go to prison, and there are plenty that fall in that category, standing there as a prosecutor at a sentencing still always gave me a knot in the pit of my stomach, because I hate to think about somebody having to go to prison, no matter who they are. And obviously we have to have them, people who are dangerous, and I prosecuted many of those, people who had killed people, massive drug rings. In Western Texas, we had everything. We had a federal judge assassinated shortly after I got there. And the Bandidos motorcycle gang then tried to kill the prosecutor two doors down from me. It was literally the Wild West for a little while. Fortunately, I was so young, I thought I was bulletproof, and there wasn't the internet for my parents to worry about me. And they didn't know how kind of rough it was those first few years in Western District of Texas. But yes, you know, obviously prisons are for people who are dangerous. As Pat Nolan with the ACU says, they should not just be for people we are mad at. We need to come up with much more creative ways of helping people reform and either kick their drug habits or educate them to the point where they can do something positive for the country, instead of spending an average of $40,000 per prisoner in tax dollars each year to have them rot away. I would encourage that you not only read License to Lie, but also Kerik's book called From Jailer to Jailed, because between those two, you will get an overview of pretty much everything that's wrong in our criminal justice system. Harvey Silverglate is a former Harvard lawyer who wrote a book called Three Felonies a Day. And the premise of that is that there are so many criminal laws now that any normal person going about their daily business commits three felonies every day without even knowing it. That is the problem of overcriminalization. Congress and everybody says, oh, there ought to be a law against that. So Congress passes a law against that. And the next thing you know, there's a Twitter feed called A Crime a Day. And that's what we've got. I mean, they've made federal regulations that ought to be purely civil into criminal offenses, and people don't even know the regulations exist in lots of cases. We've got to have a Walmart-sized rollback on things that have been over-criminalized. On top of that, we have overzealous and creative prosecutors who literally make up crimes. One of the things I talk about in License to Lie is the destruction of Arthur Andersen, the venerable accounting firm, and 85,000 jobs across the United States and other countries. It was the notorious Enron Task Force prosecutors that indicted Andersen. They did it by piecing together parts of two different statutes to make a crime out of something that was not a crime. In fact, Congress later passed Sarbanes-Oxley to fill what they perceived as the gap in the law that allowed Andersen to be reversed. And sure enough, the Supreme Court reversed Arthur Andersen in a unanimous decision that included Justice Ginsburg and others that we often rail about. But the Andersen conviction was so egregious, the decision was unanimous. The prosecutors had both made up a crime, and they had succeeded in persuading a Republican judge in Houston to take all indication of criminal intent out of the jury instructions. Well, it's criminal intent that separates a crime from a civil wrong. So if you don't have criminal intent, you should not be convicted of a crime. However, no problem for the Enron Task Force prosecutors. Just persuade the district judge to take criminal intent out of the jury instructions. They could have convicted the Pope. Those prosecutors, after destroying Arthur Andersen, turned their sights on Merrill Lynch. I'm convinced that the reason they destroyed Andersen, and they knew that's exactly what they were going to do, because Andersen represented 2,500 publicly traded companies. They sealed the indictment for a week while they worked behind the scenes to avoid upheavals in the markets before they unsealed the Andersen indictment. And of course, as soon as they unsealed it, the company had to fold. I think over 160 civil plaintiffs piled on top of the criminal charges, and all their clients had already had to leave. So Andersen was history immediately upon being indicted. You don't have to worry about a conviction. All you have to do is indict. So that's what they did. And I think they did it so that they could say then to any other target, particularly a company like Merrill Lynch, you saw what we just did to Andersen. You either agree to everything we want or we will give you the death penalty. So sure enough, when they go to Merrill Lynch next, Merrill signs the most onerous non-prosecution agreement I have ever seen. They give up all kinds of rights, including of the Merrill defendants that they offered up essentially as sacrificial lambs for Merrill executives, the nicest people you'd ever want to know, were then indicted by the Enron Task Force on the offense of conspiring to help Enron or deprive Enron of the honest services of Andrew Fastow. Now, if Andrew Fastow ever gave anybody a day of honest services, that would be a newsflash. But how anybody at Merrill Lynch could have conspired to deprive Enron of Andrew Fastow's honest services is beyond comprehension. There were no bribes. There were no kickbacks. Judge Ewing Werlein did the trial. It was a railroad operation. The defense were like deer in headlights at every turn. The Enron Task Force prosecutors had named over 100 people in Houston as unindicted co-conspirators, which meant they all lawyered up. The Merrill defendants could not even speak with their own Merrill Lynch inside house counsel about the facts of the case, even though she had actually handled the transaction from beginning to end and knew things that they didn't know. The four Merrill Lynch executives that were sacrificed on this case didn't even have authority to approve the transaction. It had to be approved above their heads. And as Judge Werlein said the day he sentenced them all to prison for up to 4 years, I realized you were just doing your jobs that day. The government decided that they were responsible for the entire downfall of Enron. It didn't matter that the transaction that they had done with Merrill produced, I think it was a $30 million profit for Enron, or that Merrill Lynch only made $775,000, or that there were no bribes by these defendants, no kickbacks. In fact, my client, Jim Brown, didn't even want to do the deal. He didn't trust Andrew Fastow, and he made that clear to everybody in Merrill. But like I said, it was approved above their heads. They were convicted, of course, by a Houston jury. The entirety of Houston was just inflamed, incensed, essentially decimated by the destruction of Enron, the fall of Enron. The big Enron building became a shell. There was one under construction that didn't get finished being built anywhere near that time. Little businesses all around had to shutter. People lost their retirement savings across the country. But without going into, you know, what exactly caused the downfall of Enron, and it was far more complicated than what the prosecutors wanted to say, it wasn't because people were stealing money from Enron, and I'm not sure it was actually criminal conduct, with the exception of the people that the government gave really sweetheart deals to. Andy Fastow and his protege, Michael Copper, were the only two that actually stole any money from Enron. Nobody they prosecuted stole any, not even Ken Layer or Jeff Skilling. And Skilling got a 24-year prison sentence, more than most murderers get. I think he wound up serving 14 years. And the only way he got his sentence reduced from 24 years to 14 years was by dropping his motion for new trial, which included government misconduct claims against then White House counsel Katherine Rumler, who started her big trail to success by being an Enron task force prosecutor. Well, the four Merrill Lynch executives having been convicted, we can't even get the bail pending appeal. One of the other things that needs to be fixed is that in nonviolent cases, we need a possibility of having bail and allowing people to stay out, particularly in these complex business prosecutions, until their case has been affirmed on appeal at the very least. Our clients had to go to prison before we could even file the appeal. The youngest Merrill Lynch executive that was sent to prison was sent to a maximum security federal transfer facility hundreds of miles from his young children and family. When we finally got the Fifth Circuit to hear the case on appeal, he was represented by Seth Waxman, who wrote one of the best insufficiency of the evidence briefs I have ever read. I would commend it to the reading of any lawyer. It was just and anybody else, frankly, it was a beautiful piece of work, and told the story of how this defendant had really no role in the transaction at all. But he spent 8 months in a maximum security federal transfer facility with the worst of the worst, because the Enron Task Force prosecutors screwed these guys over every way they could possibly find to do it. They were all sent different places. They were not put in prison camps or club fed, as some people like to call it. None of their conditions were like that. This young man was completely acquitted as soon as the Fifth Circuit got around to hearing the appeal, but that was 8 months after he spent in prison. Jim Brown, my client, served the longest time. He served a year because he'd also been convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice. Listen carefully to this. Perjury and obstruction of justice, two separate counts, for expressing his personal understanding of a telephone call he did not even participate in after Andrew Weissman, the prosecutor who was leading the Enron task force, told him to share that understanding whether it was accurate or not. Well, folks, if it's not accurate, I don't know how in the world it can be perjury. But I could not get the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals that I have loved for decades to reverse that conviction. even worse, 6 years into my participation in the case, I discover a disc that the prosecutors had given evidence before the trial, had seen evidence and reviewed it. They had yellow highlighted the evidence they knew was completely exculpatory of these Merrill defendants, but they had hidden it for 6 years. The indictment itself made up yet another crime, which I knew is just like when I read the Anderson indictment, I saw that they'd made up a crime. When I read the Merrill Lynch indictment, I saw they'd made up a crime. Never in the history of our country had there been a prosecution of somebody for depriving anyone of honest services without bribes or kickbacks or some form of self-dealing. But that's exactly what they'd done here. We pointed that out to the Fifth Circuit to try to get bail pending appeal. Still couldn't get it. So all four Merrill defendants served between 8 months and a year in prison on an indictment that did not even state a federal offense, while the prosecutors were hiding the evidence that showed they were innocent. I then watched as those prosecutors became Obama's longest-serving White House counsel, the Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice, who then micromanaged the prosecution of Senator Ted Stevens that had to be thrown out for hiding evidence that showed he was innocent. That was Matthew Friedrich. Catherine Rumler became Obama's longest-serving White House counsel. Leslie Caldwell was then brought back into Department of Justice by Loretta Lynch to head the Criminal Division. She had been the original head of the Enron Task Force. And then Andrew Weissman, none other than Andrew Weissman, whose name I'm sure you've heard, he's now on MSNBC, was, I call him the lead villain of License to Lie, because he was the ramrod of all of this. He was one of the most terroristic of the terrors of prosecutors. He became Mueller's deputy director and general counsel of the FBI. And then after a stint in private practice where he made a lot of money, Leslie Caldwell brought him back into the Department of Justice as what I call the deep state transition team to help with the Russia hoax. And he then became the head person on Mueller's special counsel operation. If you want a little entertainment, go to a website I did. I have a weird sense of humor. I call it creepsonamission.com. And there's a T-shirt to go with it. It's Robert Mueller and Andrew Weissman, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, Bruce Orr at Department of Justice, and Andy McCabe and James Comey behind a battered seal of the Department of Just-Us. And the eagle on the seal of the Department of Justice has his wing across his eyes, hanging his head in shame. You can blow up the art on your computer screen, and there's a lot of fun detail in there that you have to expand it to see. But one of the things is Comey's holding up Hillary Clinton's computer about to hit delete on 33,000 emails. And Andrew Weissman's stuffing yellow-highlighted FBI interview reports called 302s back into his briefcase. And there's some interesting names on the 302s. But I didn't realize, well, I mean, I saw the train coming. I didn't realize it would be coming at President Trump when I wrote License to Lie. But I was really glad that I published it in 2014 so that there was a warning ahead of time about what was going on. And then I knew as soon as I heard the Russia hoax and all that, and Mueller picked Weissman for his task force, exactly what was going to happen. In fact, Manafort's defense team said License to Lie. They read it because they knew it was Mueller's handbook, his playbook. What times we live in. Harvey Silverglate and I published together just in the last few weeks, I think it came out, a book called Conviction Machine, Standing Up to Federal Prosecutorial Abuse. And in that book, we do propose solutions for criminal justice reform and how to fix justice in general. We only featured about 10 different things there. Obviously, it's a much more complicated problem. But one very simple one is to insist that FBI agents, when they interview people, record the conversation, either by audio or video. Right now, they don't. Mueller testified in Congress against it. Comey probably testified in Congress against it. But what that means is then the FBI agents take whatever notes they want, and they write their 302 report. And as in General Flynn's case, it's being used to prosecute him. Supposedly, it reflects his false statements, when it doesn't reflect those at all. In fact, we haven't even been able to get the original 302, which somehow is missing, despite the fact it goes into the FBI's Sentinel system and cannot be missing. I hope the first thing Mr. Jensen does is insist that Brandon Van Grack, the prosecutor in our case, produces to him the original 302 and the audit trail that is always in the FBI's Sentinel system, because I think if he does that, and it would only take about 48 hours, he will see, for one reason or another, this case has to be dismissed. We've already shown evidence that they literally made major modifications to the 302 between the nights of February 10th and 11th, which happens to be the same time they showed the transcripts of the Flynn-Kislyak call to Vice President Pence. And Lisa Page instructed Peter Strzok to make the changes she had left on somebody's chair, and they added sentences into the 302 that weren't even reflected or referred to in their notes at all. Their notes had a material misstatement in it, or the 302 did. There was one issue where they literally, one had the word not and one didn't have the word not, so I'd kind of call that a direct contradiction. That didn't mean that Judge Sullivan, though, would order the production of that, despite the fact he's the judicial hero of License to Lie, who threw out the Ted Stevens conviction. He denied my request for Brady evidence in a 92-page decision that completely slammed us, denied absolutely everything, even though there is a, I couldn't even get the January 30 memo from DOJ that exonerates Flynn of everything they went to talk to him about. We've got a problem with our federal judges, too. It crosses both political boundaries. License to Lie crosses Republican and Democratic administrations. It's only gotten worse. So keep Attorney General Barr in your prayers. I know you keep General Flynn in your prayers, and I know a lot of you have told me that you're praying for me, too. I want everybody to know that he and I both feel it. I know that we will get this straightened out. I will not quit until General Flynn is acquitted or exonerated or all charges are dismissed. Thank you very much. We are operating from a defense fund. It's the Mike Flynn Defense Fund.org. And the generosity of the American people has been very impressive. I have no idea where the fund stands right now. I try not to ask. I can tell you that all the lawyers have cut their fees. I'm billing at the rate of about what Covington and Burling charged for their librarian. Yep, the Covington bills were pretty impressive. I think he paid them over $3.5 million to walk him into a proffer that he never should have gone to and enter a plea of guilty to crimes, a crime he did not commit. So we are in the process of straightening all that out, but I fully intend to do it. And we appreciate everyone's prayers, cards, notes, emails of support. It's been a very fulfilling experience to feel the outpouring of support from across the country. So thank you all for that. And we can fix the Department of Justice, and we can fix the FBI. It does have to start with a change in culture. A lot more people need to be fired, and a lot more power needs to be given to the inspector generals for each of the agencies that I think the Department of Justice is the only one where nobody actually investigates the lawyers for their egregious misconduct. And even President Bush stopped the practice of publishing the names of lawyers who had been found to have committed ethical violations or been sanctioned in any way. I think that public exposure needs to come back for acts of misconduct. And I would also encourage the Attorney General to make it very clear to every FBI agent and every prosecutor that any intentional and deliberate failure to provide evidence to the defense that is exculpatory and favorable to the defense will be met with a serious suspension the first time. And if it happens, no, I take that back. If they do it deliberately and intentionally, they should be fired. Accidental will take a short suspension without pay, but intentional, they must be fired because it amounts to obstruction of justice were it done by anybody else. Putting together the false charges that they put together against General Flynn isn't itself obstruction of justice. Falsifying the Carter Page email that they used to get the warrant is obstruction of justice. The Department of Justice is going to have to start prosecuting some of its own by the same standards it seeks to hold the rest of us. And I'm hopeful that we're going to see developments along those lines very shortly. It just can't take much longer because the public, we can't take much longer. Everybody is ready to see things happen right now. And with that, I'll open it to questions.
Okay. Take a few questions. Sure. Okay. Sorry to barge up here on you. Thank you very much. I forgot to mention when I introduced Sidney Powell that her talk today is sponsored by the Stonish Foundation. So Sidney Powell's talk today is sponsored by the Stonish Foundation. And with that, we have time for some questions. We have students with microphones. Please wait for the microphone to be brought to you, and we'll have some Q&A. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm remembering during Justice Kavanaugh's hearings, Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut introduced the Latin phrase that refers to a witness who is untruthful on one matter may be taken as untruthful on other matters. Is there a similar phrase for prosecutors who exhibit misconduct in one matter and what we should expect in other matters?
I just call them liars and snakes. I see a hand back there.
Question on the speaker's right.
Okay.
Thank you for your remarks, and God bless you, and I hope you succeed.
Thank you. We will.
I have a question regarding Attorney General Sessions. Where was he all those years that he was in office? It seems to me a lot of corruption was going on right under his nose. Why didn't he speak up?
Well, I think Attorney General Sessions is a good person, but he was not equipped to do that job. He allowed the career prosecutors, some of whom have recently left the department, to persuade him that it would be an ethical violation for him to continue just because he'd shaken hands with Ambassador Kislyak and in a pass-through social situation, I think it was. That was ridiculous. He should not have recused. If he was going to recuse, I think he, at the very least, he should have told the president he felt that way before he took the job, because it's essentially left us in the quagmire we've been in with the Mueller investigation. Of course, I also blame Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein, who apparently just completely fell apart at the thought of it all, and that's why he punted to special counsel. Either that or he was completely in on it. But none of it was right. There should never have been a special counsel appointed. There was no investigatory validity to hand off to a special counsel. They knew that. And the reason we have the prosecution of General Flynn, I'm convinced, is to maintain the obstruction hoax to allow it to go forward for 2 years. Because Mueller knew within a day or two there was no Russia collusion. The FBI had already been investigating it and trying to create it for 6 months and hadn't even been able to do that. But when Comey went to the White House on February 14th, which was the day after General Flynn left, he had that conversation with the president in which the president said, well, I hope you can see to let this thing go. Flynn's a really good guy. And then Comey runs out and creates one of his famous Dear Diary memos and says, that's obstruction of justice. And he starts, you know, breeding the whole obstruction of justice theory, when what he should have told the president before February 14th even was that they had investigated Flynn and cleared him of everything. The agents believed he was telling the truth. There were no lies in the January 24th meeting. And they had written a memo to DOJ on the 30th of January that he was not an agent of Russia, which was a ridiculous assertion in the first place. What they also failed to mention and will not give me are his briefings and debriefings with the Defense Intelligence Agency, for whom he continued to work as a citizen after he left the agency. He briefed and debriefed and collected information for our government when he went to Russia and gave it to them. They knew about every foreign contact he had because he was keeping them informed of it. He kept his security clearance. It's just mind-boggling that they've gotten by with this long. Absolutely mind-boggling and terrifying, because there, but for the grace of God, goes any one of us.
With Attorney General Barr now in charge, would you comment on the decision to not prosecute Andrew McCabe?
Yes, the McCabe issue. I read the declination on McCabe. It's a very narrow issue. They've only declined to prosecute him on the statements about his leaks to the Wall Street Journal. I am okay with that because I think they are looking at McCabe with a much bigger fish to fry. And I have heard that there are two sealed indictments waiting in the wings. I'm not sure what they're waiting for. At first, I would have assumed that they were definitely waiting for the impeachment, the ridiculous impeachment issue to be over. But I'm not sure now what the answer to that might be, other than maybe some people are trying to make a deal. But I think we will see some indictments within the next few months of the people who really need to be indicted.
We have a question on the speaker's right.
I have a two-part question, Cindy. The first one is, where's John Durham's report, number one? And number two is there such a thing in the law as res ipso facto? And the reason I mentioned that, when Hillary took her server to her private residence, that's res ipso facto, if I remember the old expression. Is there such a thing anymore?
Yes, it's actually res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. What happened was the double standard is what happened. I wrote an article for the New York Observer ages ago called The Countless Crimes of Hillary Clinton that went viral. I think Rush might have even read it online, on air. There are probably things she could still be indicted for, and frankly, I think should, because the Espionage Act... Very clear violations of the Espionage Act and really no issue about intent, despite President Obama proclaiming otherwise. And of course, you realize the reason that Hillary had to be protected was because he was writing her on that secret server using an alias, which shows that he damn well knew and had approved in advance her use of the secret unsecured server. On top of that, there's the Anthony Weiner laptop, which I don't know if you heard this. I wrote an article about that, too. 675,000 Clinton emails when they got Anthony Weiner's laptop in a search warrant because of all his sex perversion issues. It was all the Clinton emails, the Clinton Foundation, her Secretary of State emails, Huma Abedin's emails. Lots of people emailed Huma as a proxy for Hillary, and it included what Comey called the the golden emails, because they were the BlackBerry backup emails that they were supposedly just looking for everywhere very diligently. Well, guess what they did when they found them on the Weiner laptop? They got a search warrant for things that didn't include the BlackBerry backup emails. So when they told us, when he stood there and said that day, we've reviewed all the emails now, there's nothing there, that was a bald-faced lie. They specifically did not look at the BlackBerry backups, and they didn't look at a fraction of the emails on Anthony Weiner's laptop. So one of the things, if I were the president, I'd do is demand the Anthony Weiner laptop and get it to the most trusted person in the military to take apart everything on it and then start using it. There's a lot that can be prosecuted, I have no doubt, on that laptop. In fact, I heard that the New York police officers who saw some of it, even though they're hardened investigators, literally had to go throw up. It's bad.
Question to the speaker's left.
Sydney, I think I speak for everybody in this room in saying thank you for your courage. Thank you for being a great, great, great American, and your perseverance in doing what you do and being who you are. With that being said, from the previous speaker, I think we need to get Nick back in here, because there's plenty of movie material right here. We could make movies for a long time about this. I also want to thank you for a conversation I had with Matt Whitaker about 5 months ago. And the deep state word came up, or the hyphenated word. And he said, you know, I just can't tell you a lot of things, but I can tell you one thing. Every day you should thank God that Donald J. Trump is your president. And I want to say this to everybody in this room. Go out of here and convince somebody who wasn't going to vote for him to vote for him. This, our country is at stake. This is not a game.
No.
And last but not least, my question for you is, can you help us understand how this happens, that these people are so obviously criminal, and it just gets blown over, it just gets passed over. They never get prosecuted. And do they think we're that stupid out here? Thank you again.
They've had so much power and gotten by with it for so long, and they're so narcissistic, their hubris is just beyond bounds. They can't even fathom. I mean, Comey, I don't know what to say about Comey. I mean, really, I mean, the man is so full of himself and unfounded self-righteousness and hubris. He thinks he's untouchable and has done nothing wrong when he almost destroyed the entire FBI single-handedly. Its reputation, it will take years to recover. It's got to be rebuilt from the ground up, because it's really 20 years at least of that attitude. Mueller had it, and Comey had it, and that covers 16 years or more. So it's got to be rebuilt from the ground up and people trained to restore fidelity, bravery, and integrity. The key word there being integrity. Because if our law enforcement agents and agencies are not completely honest, we are lost.
I'm a ditto head, so I'm going to ditto what the fellow over here said.
Thank you.
But I'm also a grandma, great-grandma from Ohio. I've listened to Rush since he came on the air, and I learned a lot. Well, one of the things is that common sense has died in this country. Everything you said is just common sense. It makes me sick to listen to the news anymore, and listening to you really makes me want to throw up.
Yeah, I think that's why they saved me for the last. They didn't want y'all.
No, I did not recognize your name, but as the minute you opened your mouth, I recognized your voice because I've heard you many times on the radio. And
says I have an accent.
Whatever it is, every time I hear your voice, I think, oh, this is going to be good. I think you have such good comments on the radio, and your speech today was one of the most powerful I've ever heard. So I have no question except advice. Take care of yourself, dear girl.
Thank you.
We need people like you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Would you comment on Roger Stone's fiasco?
I have not read the transcript in the Roger Stone case. So I really can't comment on the validity of the case. I can tell you that they rushed to indict him. I can certainly tell you that the way they arrested him is an egregious abuse of power. Absolutely appalling. The same thing they did to Paul Manafort. They literally, you know, went into his house in the dark of night with his family and wife sleeping in the bed. They searched his wife at gunpoint in their bed in her nightgown. I mean, can you men even imagine that happening in your homes and having to lay there powerless and watch as FBI agents search your wife in her nightgown in the bed? It was egregious. And they should be punished just for that. I mean, the director of the FBI can certainly set a policy, and he is responsible for that because those FBI agents were still under his authority. He's on TV complaining about how they don't have money because, if you'll recall, it happened during the government shutdown. But that didn't stop them from sending 16 vehicles, a boat, frogmen, and a helicopter to go get Roger Stone, who would have walked in the next morning with his sunglasses and hat on and surrendered. The four prosecutors that resigned haven't resigned far enough. Only one of them is leaving the department. The others are still part of the department or a U.S. attorney's office. There are still any number of Mueller people in the department and in the FBI. Probably every FBI agent that was involved in that needs to be scrutinized carefully and assigned to help improve things in Alaska or an Indian reservation or something like that. They all... Well, Christopher Wray admitted the other day in his testimony that every agent who's mentioned in the Inspector General's 475-page report on the FISA abuses is under investigation.
We have time for one more question.
Will those chuckleheads see jail time? And how much?
Yeah, I think some will see jail time. I think the ones at the top will see jail time. I'm not a big proponent of lengthy jail sentences for a white-collar crime, but I think there is a certain benefit to having that experience for at least long enough to make you realize it's real. And then, for example, I was talking to Mr. Arn about Madoff. I would have sent Madoff to prison for maybe a year, and then I would have put him on an ankle bracelet and made him live in Section 8 housing and work 12 hours a day in a soup kitchen. You know, he's not dangerous to society as long as you don't let him near a computer or give him any money. But he, instead of us paying $40,000 a year in tax dollars to keep him in federal prison, he could be out doing something to serve somebody else. And I would think, you know, the same thing would be true for Hillary Clinton and other people that may be in the scope. thank you all so much for everything. The hospitality's been wonderful. It's been my honor to be here, and thank you for your prayers.